On this week's 51%, we speak with author and Pulitzer Prize winning playwright Chiara Alegria Hudes about her new book, The White Hot, about a mother who makes the controversial decision to abandon her child in pursuit of enlightenment and self-discovery.
It's the number one thing a mom should not do, and she's done it. At a certain point in the book, she starts to connect with this idea of other women that have done the unthinkable.
I'm Jesse King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on, I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh or Lita. I wasn't really in it, I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. I'm Jesse King. Thanks for joining us. Years ago on this program, I spoke with a woman who essentially decided to leave her family and young son during the COVID-19 pandemic to travel the world on her bicycle. I found it to be a very interesting conversation that I still think about today, and I got some mixed responses from listeners at the time. We understandably place a lot of anger and judgment on parents who abandon their children, but especially against mothers. That is one of the biggest things a mom is never supposed to do. Our main guest today explores this idea in her debut novel and challenges readers to reflect on their reaction. Chiara Alegria Hudes is the Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright of Water by the Spoonful and the musical In the Heights, which won the Tony Award for Best Musical and which she adapted for the screen. Her memoir, My Broken Language, was longlisted for the Andrew Carnegie Medal, and her essays have appeared in the New York Times, The Washington Post, The Cut, The Nation, and American Theater Magazine. Her new book, The White Hot, takes the form of a letter written by a mom, April, to her 18-year-old daughter, Noelle, explaining, but not apologizing for, why she suddenly abandoned her at the age of 10. April recounts the events that bubbled for generations and boiled over, causing her to flee everything she knows, and what happened in the days immediately following her departure. The White Hot is a searing and unflinching depiction of a mom's struggle toward enlightenment and self-discovery. WAMC's Sarah LeDuc spoke with Hudes about how the book came together.
Where did the seed of the idea for the story you tell in The White Hot come from?
So many seeds. You know, it's like you kind of sprinkle a handful of them, and then you lose track of what leads to what. I was very attracted to the idea of an extremely emotional young woman as our protagonist. Just feels all her feelings 100%. And I think in part that attraction was because, you know, I'm 48 now, and as I've aged, I've become a little cooler emotionally. And so to connect with a young woman who is feeling rage at 100%, is feeling joy at 100%, is feeling curiosity, reverence, all, you know, attraction. I wanted to be there. I wanted to live through her kind of saturated feel of the world. And the other seed being its inspiration is Siddhartha, the novel based on the Buddha's life story written by Hermann Hesse. And I was always kind of, I read it in high school. I was jealous of Siddhartha. I wanted to take a quest like he took. I wanted to leave my family behind and go find God. And not only did I want it for myself, I wanted it for my mother, who worked full time and then, you know, did all of the domestic responsibilities too. I wanted her to leave the sink and stop washing the dishes and go find God. She was a spiritually talented woman, and but she had to kind of pursue her spiritual journey, you know, while folding laundry. So those were the two seeds of the book.
Once you knew you wanted to tell that story and create these characters, decide on making it your first novel.
I started out thinking it was going to be a play and that she was going to be the lead character on a stage piece. And I basically wrote two scenes that remain early scenes in the book. There's a scene in the principal's office and she's getting riled up and she's getting mad. She used to get called into the principal's office when she was in high school. Now she's getting called in the principal's office because her daughter's getting in trouble. And then there's this kind of big, grand, dysfunctional family dinner table scene, which is a bread and butter staple of drama. So I wrote those as scenes. And then all of a sudden, the book pivots from this shot out of a cannon, very dramatic energy, to something much more internal about her interior life, her curiosities, her imagination. And that the stage doesn't work so well for that. And I started realizing, oh, this is, I'm going to go inside this character in a way that the stage has never let me do in the last 25 years. And so that's when I knew I was in novel territory.
I read that you had said this book is a total fiction. You made it all up. Unlike previous works, no one in it is based on anyone from your life, yet it somehow feels like the realest thing you've ever written. Why is that? How does it feel so grounded and real to you?
Part of it is because it just so happens that as I was writing this book, it was a very difficult personal time in my life. I was a full-time caretaker to a family member that was sick. And thinking about April Soto, who is the name of our lead character, thinking about April, it was my way of maintaining an inner life. So I felt so personally connected to her because she was my tether to my imagination. At a time when I was kind of being very, very domestic, she was running away from home. She was having the coming of age story she never got as a teenager. She was taking it in her 20s. And so I lived an adventure through her that I really needed more than I realized. I didn't plan on it happening that way, but that is how it happened.
How did you pick the names of the characters? Why is her name April? Why is her daughter's name Noelle?
Oh, I love those questions. I picked April because the names came to me late. There were a lot of names before that. And I landed on April because I think this story is her blossoming. It's her opening up not only to the larger world, that she's lived a very small life. She's never left Philadelphia. She's 26 years old and she blossoms into a larger life, but she also blossoms into herself, into her sense of self-possession. And so April felt good. It is her the spring of her spirit. As to Noelle, who is her daughter, and the book is written in the form of a letter that she's writing to her daughter, Noelle. One of the things I liked about the name Noelle is that it has lots of good nicknames. And so throughout the book, as she's addressing her daughter, sometimes she addresses her as Noelle, sometimes she addresses her as Nolita, sometimes she addresses her as Noe. And so it gives us a sense of familiarity and playfulness with the name.
One of the things that I kept noting through the book as April is on her initial journey and telling the story 10 years later in the letter, as you mentioned, she makes a lot of choices that are correct for her, but that society would look down upon her for, like leaving her child, obviously. She does think, and it's, written things, well, you can't do that, so we're not doing it. And then in the next paragraph, you're like, and she left. I loved the having her think the obligatory choice and you showing us that what she would do if she were going to follow a more trod path, and then the doing what she needs to do to really start this mission.
Yeah, it's we all have these scripts of how we're supposed to behave and what makes us a proper young lady and a proper daughter, and in her case, also a proper mother. And those scripts become internalized and we become their kind of greatest embodiment of them. And so they're still very strong. She knows she's doing things she should not do. And we know from the first page of the book, she has left her daughter. It's the number one thing a mom should not do, and she's done it. And I think it's really important then that at a certain point in the book, she starts to connect with this idea of other female pariahs, other women in literary history that have done the unthinkable. She goes to a librarian and says, "Has anyone ever done this before? Are there any books about a mother who's left her child?" And the librarian has quite a long list. There's a real bibliography that backs her up. And she realizes, I'm not alone here. And for me, I enjoyed reading a lot of books about female pariahs that were gorgeous works about women who lived experimental lives. I'm thinking about Sula by Toni Morrison. I'm thinking about Elena Ferrante's work. I'm thinking about Jamaica Kincaid's work. And I read those books to fortify my own courage to let April make the wrong choices and imbue her with a complication that made the reader go, I don't feel comfortable with that choice. And yet, part of me is rooting for April.
I saw a play at Manhattan Theater Club a number of years ago now by Liz Flahive that Lee Silverman directed called The Madrid, and Edie Falco played a character who left her family, who left her kids. And in a talk back after the performance, I saw a woman, an older woman in the audience, was reprimanding her for doing that, because it is like the thing a woman is not supposed to do if they have kids is to leave them. And I've thought about that a lot, and then was thinking about that again while reading your novel, that it is like the reaction you have to face, the judgment from society is incredibly heavy.
Yes, and in April's case, there's that outer judgment, but I think in the end, the long-term most difficult part is she really loved her daughter and really liked her daughter. And she makes a decision that she thinks is for her daughter's welfare, which is I'm going to leave her in more capable hands. But that's a real sacrifice. She misses her daughter's company. She knows that she'll never get to earn the closeness that she would have had otherwise if she had kind of stuck it out. And so there's this line towards the end where she says, she has to look in the unvarnished mirror every day. Yeah, so she feels it from outside and from inside.
She says to in the letter, "Do not absolve me, do not forgive me, but hear me and consider my story." And it really feels, I mean, it's incredibly tumultuous, but also really brightening as she, you can feel April facing and releasing the shame that she's been holding since getting pregnant in high school, even all of it.
Yes, the shame is really big, and I'm glad that you bring up that word because she's drowning in it. She's really drowning in it, and she really wants to take a breath. And I do think the book is her journey towards taking a breath. And this line that you bring up of don't forgive me, don't absolve me, just hear me out. This is a direct inspiration from Frankenstein. I read Frankenstein again while I was writing the book. It's one of my all-time favorites, and now everyone's talking about it because of the movie. And I think April feels like the monster. She feels like the creation. She didn't ask to be made, but here she is. And Frankenstein's creation says in the book, just hear me. Just hear me. You don't have to forgive me, but hear me. That's actually what humanity demands, not absolution, but an audience, a narrative. And that's what April's trying to put together for herself.
As you were writing this novel, and I suppose it transfers in a different way to when you were writing your memoir versus writing the many plays and books of musicals you've written, is there a different way that you're thinking about the audience and how it will be received? Because there is an audience either way, but you'll encounter them very differently through the different mediums.
Yes, that was one of the most wonderful parts of writing the novel. In the theater, the dialogue really has to project to the back row. And sometimes the back row is, four rows back, but sometimes you're in a Broadway house and it's the back row of the balcony and it's 100 feet away. So you have to say it loud. It's got to be heard. In the book, you can really whisper right in someone's ear. The opportunities for subtlety and immediacy are quite different. And so I loved this notion that I was going to get to whisper in a reader's ear, especially because the beginning of the book really is like a runaway freight train. It's wild, it's intense, it's kind of exciting, it's very fanged and thorny. And then we get to more contemplative registers. And I just love feeling like the reader can be an audience to her quiet moments too. That was very exciting for me.
April goes into and finds the beginning of some solace in nature, in the woods. Do you have a meditative connection to being outdoors? I know you're a city girl, but that doesn't mean you couldn't have experienced much nature in your life.
Yeah. For me, my version of it is walking. I walk as part of my writing practice, and I just kind of walk when I'm bored. I love it. I walk everywhere. And that sense of fresh air, that sense of motion, one of the things I love when I'm taking a stroll is that what you're looking at changes with every step. The angles change, the perspective on it changes. The world feels like kind of a constantly opening up and reopening pop-up book or something. So I do relate to April. She goes and takes a pilgrimage in the woods, just like the Buddha does, and Siddhartha goes on his kind of nature quest, renounces all worldly possessions. And so April does that too. And I tried to do hers with a little humor. You know, she's very poorly dressed. She's wearing skinny jeans from work and her gladiator sandals from work. So she's just not dressed properly. She's never been in the woods before. She has to figure out how to get some fresh drinking water. She gets caught in a storm and, you know, she's surprised by her body odor after a few days. She realizes she never even really knew how she smelled because she showers every day. So, you know, I tried to approach some of that natural wonderland with some humor.
When you are writing, whether it's when you're, you know, when you're walking or when you're actually at your keyboard or in your writing studio, how can you tell, how do you know for you that it's working and that you will keep committing to the project, to the characters, to the story?
A sense of ongoing curiosity and wonder. I like to know a little bit of where I'm going, but also be forced to make discoveries along the way. And there were times when I discovered where April was going that I was really shocked by, surprised by, that I found very moving, that I didn't like. You know, she steals a car at one point and I was, you
a
know,
nice
I was
car.
Like, oh, she's going there. Yeah, she steals a really nice car, messes it up a little bit. So I never know if it's working. You never know. But if I'm feeling engaged, that's usually a good sign. And then one of my old tricks, my old writing tricks, is I'll read it out loud, whether it's a play, whether it was this book. And the moment my mind starts to wander, I'm like, oh, I wasn't interested in my own writing there. So that's a little clue to go back and see what fell flat there.
As it does in a lot of your work, music plays a huge role in this story for April, and the music of Jimi Hendrix and Charles Mingus really propel part of the story along with what the music feels like, what it sounds like, and what it means. Did you listen to those artists while you wrote, or do you not listen to music while you write?
I listened to music all the time. Because she goes on this pilgrimage, kind of accidental pilgrimage, the book is almost a series of firsts for her. And that includes the first time she hears jazz, the first time she hears Jimi Hendrix. She meets up with an audiophile and he kind of turns her on to this music. And in part, she's mad because she had gone her whole young adult life never having exposure to this kind of basic American music. And so she wants to make up for lost time. So she goes on a deep dive. She's listening a lot. And what she's hearing in the Mingus is exactly what I heard listening to the Mingus, that he has a lot of complicated, angry emotions, and he found a way to make them into something beautiful. Now, she's also had a lot of complicated and angry emotions. Those landed her in the principal's office, as opposed to having the ability to transform them and turn them into something that has artistic or human merit. So she's on a path to figure out, what can I do with my anger that has use, like what Charles Mingus did, like what Jimi Hendrix did with his electric guitar.
How have male readers reacted to the story?
So I was very curious. I thought, okay, this is definitely a book for women, and it's a book that's going to divide women. And actually what I found is men get very weepy reading this book. Truly a surprise to me. And I don't know why. I can't account for it, but I have found really strong support in male readership, which has been lovely. My first two readers were my husband and my daughter, who is 18. And I tried to make the book open-ended. So she does this thing, she leaves her daughter, and I didn't want to tell the reader how to feel about it. I wanted to really put that question in the reader's lap. You know, you close the book, you read the last sentence, you close the book. So how do you feel? Is it okay what April did? And so my husband and my daughter were my test cases. They read it. I said to them, all right, so what do you think? Is what April did okay? And my husband said, absolutely, no gray area. She saved her daughter's life. And my daughter, who's 18, was much more conflicted. She, you know, she doesn't want mommy to go. And she said, I don't know that wound ever heals. And so I felt that I was on the right path because I had these two different responses, but they both felt very attached to April too.
That was author and playwright Chiara Alegria-Hewdy speaking with WAMC's Sarah LaDuke about her new novel, The White Hot, out now through One World Publishers. You can learn more about Chiara's work at Chiara.com. In the many headlines from this week, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services froze $10 billion in funding for social services and child care through the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program and the Child Care Development Fund. As first reported by the New York Post, the funding cuts have been targeted at five Democratic-led states, including New York, Minnesota, California, Illinois, and Colorado. These freezes follow the Trump administration's plans to tighten rules for federal child care funds after a series of alleged fraud schemes at Minnesota daycare centers and confirmation that the funding is on hold for all states until they provide more verification about child care programs. New York lawmakers on both sides of the political aisle decried the decision and called on the federal government to release the funds. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer said the funding is, quote, critical support for working families and child care providers in the state. Democratic Senator Kirsten Gillibrand said the move is political retaliation at the expense of children and families, and that HHS did not provide any evidence of the fraud it is citing in the decision.
We all agree fraud is unacceptable and should be investigated. Those who misuse our tax dollars should be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. But without any substantial proof of fraud, the administration is choosing to rip funding away from thousands of child care providers and parents across our state.
Speaking at a virtual press conference, Gillibrand said New Yorkers are losing out on more than $3 billion.
These are New York tax dollars that we paid into the federal government. So they are stealing our New York dollars.
New York Congressman Mike Lawler, a Republican from the 17th District, also called on the Trump administration to restore the funding, saying he agrees with the administration's efforts to cut down on wasteful spending, but that it must do so, quote, without cutting off critical funding, end quote. As of this taping, the funding has not been restored. Child care, specifically universal child care, has become a very hot topic in New York. Political will and public opinion are at an all-time high, but the real question is if lawmakers can embrace the price tag. Amy Feiereisel from the New York Public News Network reports on the current landscape.
There's a lot of power and energy behind childcare in New York right now. Since taking office, it's been a cornerstone of Governor Kathy Hochul's policy agenda. She regularly calls herself the first mom governor.
So I decided when I first became governor 4 years ago that I was going to invest heavily in childcare. No other governor before me had even talked about it.
That's Hochul at a Brooklyn childcare summit this past fall. At it, she reiterated universal childcare as a top priority. She said it's an economic need to keep young families in the state.
We're losing them. We're going to lose them. And that's the talent that I do not want to see walk out the door because we didn't have the ambition or the ability to solve this problem.
New York City's new mayor, Zohran Mamdani, representing half the state's population, also made universal childcare, as in free childcare for all, a key part of his campaign. And it's something the New York legislature has really gotten behind in recent years.
We have met with legislators across the aisle, across the state of all political stripes, and this is a consistent issue, whether it is in urban, suburban, or rural areas.
Shoshana Hershkowitz is the campaign manager for the Empire State Campaign for Child Care. It's just one of the groups in New York that's proposed a plan or roadmap to universal child care in the last few months, hoping to capitalize on current political will. Hershkowitz says child care is the path to a more affordable New York.
New York families are struggling, and all of the data is showing that it is lower and middle income families that are leaving the state. And other than housing, child care is the largest expense for families.
The Empire State Campaign for Child Care lays out a 6-year roadmap that would fully fund the state's existing child care subsidy program, raise the average wage of child care workers, and eventually cap maximum child care costs for all families at $100 a week. Now, if you're thinking that sounds expensive, you're right. Existing universal child care proposals range from the $2 billion range up to $20 billion annually. And that's really the biggest hang-up.
Childcare has become actually an interesting policy issue in that, in a sense, everyone agrees.
Nathan Gustorf is the executive director of the Fiscal Policy Institute, which is a left-leaning think tank in New York.
Everyone agrees that it's too expensive, that it's really important for families to be able to afford childcare. And if they can't afford childcare, they may have to literally move to a place with a lower cost of living.
Yet that bipartisan support only goes so far, says Gustorf.
That degree of consensus in childcare policy obviously has not translated into a universal childcare plan. And really, it's just because it's very expensive.
The Fiscal Policy Institute estimates a $10 billion annual price tag. In a $250 billion annual budget, Gustorf says that's not ridiculous, but it would require Governor Hochul and the state legislature to raise taxes, in an election year, no less.
And that means debating the tax side and being serious about the revenue needed to fund it. So that's truly the hurdle.
But there may be more willingness there than in the past. The governor's office recently said it's exploring revenue options, including an increase to corporate tax rates. Crucially, the court of public opinion has been enthusiastic. A recent Siena poll released in mid-December showed that nearly 2 in 3 voters in New York favor universal childcare and support funding it by increasing taxes on the rich. Advocates believe that broad public support means something will likely make it into this year's state budget. Whether it will truly be universal is the real question mark. For the New York Public News Network, I'm Amy Feiereisel.
Shortly before this taping, New York Governor Kathy Hochul previewed her State of the State message, announcing plans to invest significantly in child care across the state. Joining with New York City Mayor Mamdani, the Democrat announced plans to fund child care for 2-year-olds in the city. Across the rest of the state, Hochul wants to strengthen universal pre-K for communities that have struggled to provide services.
Communities have just not found a way to implement this, and that's a real barrier for families living outside the city. We're going to invest $470 million to support the administration of universal pre-K across all of our towns and our cities and deliver on the guarantee I'm making today that universal pre-K will be available for every single 4-year-old across New York by 2028, 2 years from now.
Hochul says she also wants to create a network of community-based daycare centers for newborns to 3-year-olds and increase funding for the state's child care voucher program by 40%. Hochul's full State of the State address is scheduled for Tuesday, January 13th. Thanks for listening to this week's 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Madeline Reynolds, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at wamcpodcast.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can stay in the loop on all of WAMC's shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King, 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half, he was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along the way. At night, air down the hallway, I had to learn how to look away. I lost my cool.